I am participating from Iraq. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to show my talent here in this event.
I have to represent our culture, Indian culture, and when I was in the start in the Tehran, then how I managed to live, because I didn't know the Persian language.
The contest has four categories of singing: stand-up comedy, show hosting, and sound impression. Contestants say this stage provides a shortcut to their success.
I'm so happy to be able to take part in this international talent contest. It provides a great opportunity for stage talent to be seen and shine in their favorite fields.
Stage Stars is a good chance for singers, sound impressionists, and stand-up comedians to be discovered. It's a big leg up for them.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say only their real talents will be picked for the top prize.
This is a competition between the professionals of stage performance. There is no chance for a mistake. Each contestant here has a strong background in their expertise, so this stage is not the starting point, but a milestone for their careers.
One interesting part of this festival is the participation of international talents, who are mainly students from other countries who study in Iran. There's a separate competition dedicated for foreign participants.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival. The top performances from each category will win the golden mic, plus a cash prize.
Organizers say this contest seeks to scout for those who really have a knack for stage performance and to bring them under the spotlight. So to those who nab the golden mic here, this stage is a springboard toward their ambitions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
In the limelight.
The US leader is reportedly planning to offer a security pact similar to the Abraham Accords, finalized under his predecessor, to the autocratic regimes in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, says Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute, in an article published under the heading Biden's policy increasingly looks like Trump's West Asia strategy. Stay tuned for more. All the latest headlines about President Joe Biden's July trip to Saudi Arabia focus on a deal to push down gas prices. In reality, he's making a much more sinister and dangerous calculation than most realize. He's reportedly planning to offer the dictators in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, where all but two of the 9/11 terrorists came from, a defense pact that commits American lives to defend the regimes. What could go right? When Biden ran for the White House, he pledged to break with then-President Donald Trump's West Asia policy. Bring U.S. troops home from the West Asia-North Africa region, renew the Iran nuclear deal, end the war in Yemen, and make the Saudis the pariah that they are. But after refusing to take necessary steps to return to the Iran deal, and with rumors abounding that he is about to offer the UAE and Saudi Arabia a defense pact, Biden's policy is increasingly looking like a continuation of Trump's West Asia strategy. Biden isn't just forgiving Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for his direct role in the beheading of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in return for a Saudi promise to pump more oil. As Biden admitted last week, this West Asia trip is about regional security and that of the Zionist regime in particular. Biden told reporters on June 12th, "The commitments from the Saudis don't relate to anything having to do with energy. It happens to be a larger meeting taking place in Saudi Arabia. That's the reason I'm going. And it has to do with the national security for them, for Israelis," unquote. Rumors have been circulating in Washington for months that Biden is seeking to expand Trump's signature foreign policy initiative, the Abraham Accords, which normalize diplomatic relations between the Israeli regime and Bahrain and UAE. Biden wants to bring Saudi Arabia into a similar kind of arrangement with the fake regime of Israel. Details are beginning to leak of how he will try to get Saudi Arabia to take critical steps toward recognizing the fabricated regime of Israel. And the most alarming one is that the United States of America is offering a major security pact to autocratic regimes in Saudi Arabia and UAE. According to a source close to the ruler of the Emirates, this would be a binding strategic defense cooperation pact that goes beyond anything the U.S. has agreed to in the region before. Former Biden advisor David Shapiro confirmed to Newsweek magazine that Saudi Arabia was looking for assurances that the U.S. will retain significant military presence in the region to help Saudi Arabia address the threats it faces, as well as to take Saudi Arabia's side in its gruesome war in Yemen. Committing American lives to defend these Arab dictators is far more scandalous than an embarrassing presidential handshake with the Saudi crown prince. Biden will in one swoop break his promises of bringing troops home from the West Asia North Africa region, making Saudi Arabia pay a price and ending the war in Yemen. For the U.S., this amounts to an awful deal. It's all give and no take, because none of what the Persian Gulf states are offering is likely to pan out. To start with, establishing full diplomatic relations with the Zionist regime is a concession to this regime, not to the U.S. It does not advance U.S. security one iota. Nor does it bring peace to Palestine or stability to the West Asia North Africa region, which the experience thus far with the Abraham Accords already has proven. Indeed, peace is not really the objective. Rather, according to Jared Kushner's August 2021 annual strategy document of the Abraham Accords Peace Institute, the objective is to move beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict. In that spirit, the Biden administration has not pressed the Israeli regime for any concessions to the Palestinians as part of this agreement. Instead, Biden has requested that the Zionist regime refrain from any provocative actions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds that could inflame tensions ahead of his visit. Once his visit is over, Biden will presumably have no objections to the Zionist regime's ongoing repression of the Palestinians. Instead, and indeed, the Zionist regime's creeping annexation of Palestinian territory has accelerated since the Abraham Accords was signed. As Zaha Hassan and Marwan Mohasher write in Foreign Affairs, "The truth is that the Accords have not advanced peace in the Middle East because Israel's aim in signing the Accords was to redirect world attention away from its military occupation, not to end it," unquote. This is not a recipe for peace, but for violence. Not surprisingly, during the first 3 months of this year, almost 50 Palestinians were murdered by the fake regime of Israel. The Palestinian deaths are a five-fold increase over the same period the previous year. Secondly, Biden's game is also unlikely to push down skyrocketing gas prices. Experts are skeptical that the Saudis sit on enough unused capacity to push down American gas prices substantially. The root of the problem is Washington's over-reliance on Saudi Arabia, a dependence that will only grow more damaging to U.S. interests as Biden moves closer to the Wahhabi kingdom at the expense of diversifying America's relations in the West Asia-North Africa region. Thirdly, Biden's defense pact is not likely to make the West Asia-North Africa region overall more secure. The Abraham Accords, contrary to claims that they are a creative new approach to the security in West Asia-North Africa region, continue a four-decade-long failed American strategy in the region. Perhaps the most important commitment the U.S. will seek to extract from Saudi Arabia and the UAE is alignment with America's strategy to confront Russia and China. The Saudis will make certain commitments about remaining fully aligned with the United States in its competition with Russia and China, Shapiro told Newsweek. But there is little to suggest that Biden's strategy of showering the Saudi crown prince and the ruler of the UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, with concessions will bring about a sustainable Saudi Emirati commitment to the U.S. side in great power competition of this century. The Saudi crown prince has driven an uncompromising line with Biden. He famously shrugged off Biden's refusal to engage with him during the initial stage of his presidency. "I simply do not care," he told The Atlantic and patiently waited for Biden to cave. The Saudis are already dictating the terms of Biden's visit, forcing Biden to see the crown prince before he is allowed to meet any other Saudi official. Giving the crown prince more is not likely to make him more malleable, as political scientists Patricia Sullivan, Brock Tessman, and Chun John Lee's research shows that increasing levels of U.S. military aid significantly reduce cooperative foreign policy behavior with the United States. The most likely outcome of Biden's meeting with the crown prince is that Saudi Arabia and the UAE will pocket Biden's many concessions and offer tactical collaboration against Russia and China in the short run, while keeping their options open to betray Washington down the road. If they truly believe that they shouldn't risk against China and Russia in this competition, they would not have needed all these American concessions to align themselves with the U.S. Biden is now completing what Trump started.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Principles of Friendship. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, dear listeners, my name is Hussein Hinzano, and you're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. In today's lesson, we want to talk about principles of friendship. And the main point that we're talking about in this particular minute is how to be a successful friend. Among the principles of friendship is for us to check on how we can be successful friends whenever we are planning to start any relationship in our lives. Whenever we are planning to start any relationship in our lives, friendship relationship, partnership relationship, or whatever it is, we need, first of all, to consider that. How can we make this relationship be successful? How can I gain out of this relationship? And how can my partner, the one that I want him to be my friend, how can he gain from me? And by gaining, we're not talking of material purposes. We're not talking of worldly matters, worldly issues. No. When we're talking about how can I gain, how can I add something in my life, add value in my life through this particular person, we are talking about us building each other intellectually, spiritually, habitually, socially. How can I build the social life of my friend and make it a good social life? If my friend is having a problem in his social life, if my friend have a low self-esteem, what can I do in my life until I help him improve his self-esteem in front of people? How can I help him do that? That's what we need to consider for us to have a successful friendship. Considering that the particular person I'm living with, I need to make sure that apart from knowing them, I need to make sure that I am doing my best to improve them. So among the best things for us to consider is for us to make sure that we are helping our friends be better than we made them, and vice versa. Them too should be considering the same. And that way, definitely we will head and we will lead ourselves to successful relationships, to successful friendships.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to A to Z program from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the principles of friendship. And we were talking about a very important thing, and that was how to be a successful friendship, or how to build a successful friendships. Now, we say that one of the things is for us to make sure that we are doing our best to improve our partners, to make them good in whatever they are weak at, in whatever they need. Now, the Holy Quran has outlined the sacrifices made by the righteous companions of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The companions of the Holy Prophet, the Sahaba of the Holy Prophet, lived in a sincere friendship. They had a good friendship between them. For example, the Ansar. Who are the Ansar? The people of Medina. The people of Medina sacrificed and presented all of what the Muhajirun, or the people of Mecca. The Ansar are the people of Medina, and the Muhajirun are the people of Mecca. Now, the people of Medina, the Ansar, sacrificed and presented all of what the Muhajirun needed. The time the Muhajirun came, they provided them shelter, food, clothes, money, even if they're in need of these things themselves. You see, the Ansar weren't really rich people. We cannot say they were rich people, but they did their best to provide what the Muhajirun needed in their life. Why? They were seeking nothing except Allah's pleasure. And as we said, when you're trying to build your friend, when you're trying to improve your friend's life, make sure that you're seeking nothing except Allah's pleasure and not the worldly issues, not the worldly matters. The Holy Quran says in chapter 59, verse number 9, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ And those who made their abode in the city and in faith before them, love those who have fled to them. It's referring to the issue of the Ansar and the Muhajirun. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just the day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, but Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, "It's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program." He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
Yeah, I mean, this is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia, and so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the US and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-a-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognised there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the U.S. out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the U.S. is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
As the underpinnings of many Western countries are being called into question, China is holding out both its political and economic model as a thriving alternative. Over the past four decades, Beijing has increasingly asserted its power on the global stage and is now on course to become the world's biggest economy even sooner than predicted pre-pandemic. But now, as the world undergoes changes unseen in decades, China alongside Russia seem to be embroiled in a battle with the West, both in terms of economies and military might, a battle which the West seems to be on the losing side. Amid simmering tensions between the two sides, the former British Prime Minister says the Ukraine war is an indication of the West's diminishing dominance. Tony Blair stated that the West's dominance is coming to an end as China rises to superpower status in partnership with Russia at one of the most significant inflection points in centuries.
The collective West needs to take into account now is that they are not alone. They need to stop their imperialist way of approaching how they see the world. They tend to say, well, the global worlds, but when they say the global world, they only mean maybe 15% of the population. But the problem now is that they don't have the weight they used to have, and they need to take into account that you have an emerging world, and we are living the last days of the imperialistic West.
From trade wars against China to sanctions on many countries, including Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, the West has in the past decade went on a rampage against any nation not willing to play by its rules. But now, the West's risky games have backfired, and signs of distress are multiplying, with falling currency valuation, social crisis, inflation, poverty, and much more. Those coercive measures also, however, push targeted nations closer to each other, setting the foundations of a multilateral world. In the 1960s, while the US was putting a man on the moon, China was struggling to feed its 1 billion people during the decade-long Cultural Revolution. The US was enjoying a favorable economic environment, And China, on the other hand, was faced with a completely stagnant and ruined economy coupled with widespread famine. But nearly two decades later, in light of vast economic reforms, China opened up to private businesses and foreign investment. Dominant state-owned bank turned savings into financing tools for roads, rail links, and ports, all this while foreign firms were forced to set up alongside a local partner, encouraging the transfer of technology. As a result, the economy grew 90-fold over the next four decades. But history clearly shows that plagues and wars are things that either cause the downfalls of particular order or cause a rethink. So when these disasters arise, a void is created waiting to be filled by a superior nation or nations.
I think it's not about, you know, either one pole or the other. You know, we might enter into a bipolar world or ideally a multipolar world. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a complete downfall. You know, the world needs the West. It's not about either or. It is about how we can live together. But if the West keeps on going into this direction, it might be a downfall, especially when you look at the economy. How are they going to manage when the dollar is not going to be the global currency? Now the dollar being a global currency makes the U.S., gives the U.S. this power to print endless paper, which is backed by nothing. So that, if we talk about downfall, well, we might have an economic downfall, because the day that the dollar is no more the global currency, hegemonic currency, then you then will experience hyperinflation, and it could be extremely dramatic.
In the past couple of years, not only China, but several sovereign nations, including Russia and Iran, demonstrated the power which can be gained through sovereignty. And countries relying on the West, on the other hand, presented an example of the problems that could arise upon relying on others. From the formation of new allegiances such as the BRICS or the G20 to a shift away from a unipolar world and dependency on the US, all signs indicate a shift in global order towards a multilateral world.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله محمد.
السلام عليكم and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Xavier International Schools Network. Thank you so much for joining us again. Thank you so much, respected brothers. Brother Ali Nasser, salam alaikum. How are you?
Salam, alhamdulillah.
Fine, inshallah. That's great. How about Hussein Ruhullah? Salam.
Salam alaikum.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Fawad Haider, salam alaikum. Are you good?
Yes, salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
في القرآن سعادتنا مدى الأزمان وفيه الخير للإنسان ويطوي عثرة المجروح ويطوي عثرة المجروح.
So, respected brothers and sisters, thanks for joining us again and listening to us. Inshallah, in this session, we are going to continue learning about the Nuni Sakina and Tanween rules. One very important point is here that I have to tell you. Please go to page 578 of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Qiyam. Okay? There is a special rule for page 578, Ayah 27. Ayah 27. وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاقَ. Do you see it? Okay.
Yes.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وقيل من راق. There is a Nuni Sakin, right? And after Nuni Sakin we have Ra, the letter Ra. What rule should we apply?
مراق we should.
Ah, إدغام, yes? While you listen to the reciters, they recite this way. وقيل من راق. No idgham.
Izhar.
Why?
No idhar.
Why they stop here?
They stop here. If you take a look, there is written a baby scene is
yes,
on the top.
Yes.
So what does it mean? No.
Laq.
No. Scene is the sign of sakt. Have you heard in Persian they say sakte? Sakte marzi?
Yes.
Okay. Sakt. It means like kind of heart attack. Okay, so here this sign tells you that you have to kind of break your breath, okay, and just make a pause, okay, without taking another breath, with the same breath, okay. وَقِيلَ مَن, no other breath, the same breath, just make a pause here, do not read it, do not connect them. وَقِيلَ مَن رَاق, just a small pause, then continue. Okay, this way if you recite, the meaning that which is meant by this ayah will be clear. But if you connect them, if you merge the Nuni Sakin with Ra, the meaning changes. So the rule idgham is not applied here. This is an exceptional case here. Okay, how do you recite? وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاقَ. Okay, وَقِيلَ مَنْ راق. Can you recite?
Yes.
Hussain Ruhullah.
وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاق.
أحسن. Ali Nasir.
Yes. وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاق.
أحسن. Without taking another breath. Fawad. Yeah. Recite.
وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاق.
أحسن. وَقِيلَ مَنْ رَاق. أحسن. Okay, well, ظَنَّ أَنَّهُ الْفِرَاقِ, and the rest of the ayahs. So, this is an exceptional case. We have this scene sign again in Surah Al-Mutaffifin, okay? Ayah 14. If you take a look at Surah Al-Mutaffifin, page 588. كَلَّا بَلْ. Ayah 14, Surah Al-Mutaffifin, we have this scene. But it's not the exceptional case about idgham, okay? It is just the scene sign. The scene sign. كَلَّا بَلْ رَانَ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ مَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ. Have you seen that ayah? Ayah 14. Take a look, ayah 14. كَلَّا بَلْ رَانَ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ. Ali Nasir? Have you found it?
Yes.
Okay, recite it. Make a pause without taking another breath, okay?
كَلَّا بَلْ رَانَ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ.
Ahsan, mashallah. If you take another breath, it means you stopped here. It means you just stopped here and you started again. So again, it does not convey or give the meaning, okay? Which is meant by. So, Tajweed rule says that you have to make a pause without taking another breath. With the same breath, you have to continue. Okay? Hussain Ruhullah?
كَلَّا بَلْ رَانَ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ.
Yeah, make a pause. A little longer. Two beats, kind of.
كلا بل ران على قلوبهم.
When the reciters, okay, sometimes Shahad, I think, one of his reciting is, I've listened to it a lot, okay? He recites the surah, okay? And he makes a pause without taking another breath, okay? And people, okay, who are listening, the audience, okay, they applaud, mashallah, Allah, Allah. Then he continues. They become kind of confused. Why did he do this? They thought that he finished the ayah. And they said, Allahu Akbar, Takbir, Allah, Allah, okay, mashallah. But at the middle, while they were saying this, okay, he continued. I forgot right now. For example, like this. Kallabal, Allah, Allah, Allah. Everyone says, Rana ala. He continued, okay? It was another ayah, the same as this, okay? So sometimes we kind of misunderstand that he finished the ayah, but no, he has not finished, okay? It's just a small pause without taking another breath. Fawad, recite this. Kallabal.
Kallabal.
Rana, ahsan.
Rana.
Great. Ala. Read it again. Read it again.
Kallabal. Rana ala kulubi.
MashaAllah. Ahsan, ahsan. Okay. So, alhamdulillah, that was all about idgham, ikhfa, ilhar, iqlab. Like, we just took a very big step, okay? And alhamdulillah, we finished a very important point regarding nun sakin or tanween.
يبكي يسأل خالقه فأتاه الوحي فأشرق اقرأ اقرأ.
Let's recite the Quran.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
And one more thing, when tanween, we studied this one in level 2. Just review this. Whenever tanween approaches Hamzatul Wasl. Okay, Hamzatul Wasl. For example, the word Yawma Idin Al Mustaqar. Yawma Idin Tanween Al Mustaqar. A Hamza of the word Al Mustaqar is Hamzatul Wasl. So whenever you connect two words, this Hamzatul Wasl will be skipped. So Yawma Idin, here the Tanween will be given a noon with Kasra, will be changed to a noon with Kasra. Okay, يَوْمَ إِذِن in sound will have that kasra and noon. يَوْمَ إِذِ noon with kasra. يَوْمَ إِذِ plus noon kasra. Maksur noon. يَوْمَ إِذِ ni connected with lam. يَوْمَ إِذِ nil mustaqar.
Yes.
يَوْمَ إِذِ nil mustaqar. يَوْمَ إِذِ Nil mustaqar. Nun is talking as well sometimes like this. Man alladhi. How do you say this?
Man
alladhi. Okay. Man alladhi, man alladhi. In some of the du'as we have a lot. Okay, this one. So, just remember this kasra. I mean tanween. Tanween, whenever approaches Hamzatul Wasl, you apply this rule, okay? Change that tanween sound to a nun maksura and join it with that next word and skip Hamzatul Wasl. That we practice this in level 2. So let's recite a salawat that we finished a very important point.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajam.
Some words are here, okay? That I will read the words. You have to apply the rule, idgham, ikhfa, whatever it is. You have to guess and apply the rule, okay? Then we'll go to Surah Al-A'la and recite this surah and practice all the rules, okay? Because it is important. I told you, you need to practice a lot, and it needs time, okay? So we will practice here as well. But the rest of the exercises you have to do at home, wherever you recite Quran, okay? You have to do it. So, Fawad Haider, min ahli, apply the rule. What rule? Tell us what rule is applied and how you apply it. Min ahli. I told you the important, there are three steps. Three steps. Fawad. Number one, you find the tanween or nun sakin. Number two, you find the next letter after tanween or nun sakin. Number three, you know things, okay, about what letters we should apply this rule, what letters we should apply the other rule, okay? Then apply the rule. Find the tanween nun sakin, Find the next letter. Identify the next letter. Apply the rule.
Min ahli.
Min ahli.
Izhar.
Izhar. Apply the rule. MashaAllah. Why? Because?
Because alif is in the last.
Hamza is. After?
What's the difference? Nun
Sakin. Okay. What is the difference of Hamza and Aleph? Aleph is used to stretch the sound. This sound is Aleph.
Hamza
sound.
Is an individual.
No. Hamza is, yes, it is a letter. It is a separate letter. And whenever you see a sound, so Aleph on the top of Aleph Hamza, that is Hamza.
Why it is written with Aleph?
Because it sometimes comes with Aleph. It sometimes comes with Waw. It is just Hamza. Okay? It comes anywhere it wants. Sometimes on the top of Ya, sometimes beneath Alif, sometimes on beneath Ya, okay? Sometimes on the top of Waw, Alif, wherever it wants, sometimes separately, okay? Different forms of Hamza is this. Hamza has only one form, but it appears with some other letters, okay? Sometimes. So it is a kind of writing style in Arabic, okay? But before, okay, last in during the history, I've studied, okay? I've learned. I've read actually in some of the books, okay, that Hamza used to come alone, okay, without any other letters. But during the history, okay, it has been changed and it has taken different forms as well, okay? Sometimes with Aleph, with Waw, with Mu'minun, for example. The word Mu'minun, it is Mim and Waw. There is no Hamza. But on the top of Waw, there is a Hamza.
Yes.
Mu'minun, okay? It's written as Mu'minun, but pronounced as Mu'minun, okay? Like this, Yawma Idin, E. That's Ye, Yawma Yidin. We have to recite, okay? But there is a Hamza on the top of Ya, Yawma Idin. So, Fawad, Min Ahli, the rule Izhar, how do you read it?
Min Ahli.
Min Ahli, without changes, mashallah. Narun Hamiyah. Hussein Ruhullah?
It is Izhar.
Izhar, why?
Because Ha is also from.
How do you recite this?
Letters. Narun Hamiyah.
Ahsan. Great. But there is a good thing to say to Ali Nasir that we need to take a break, okay? I'll ask you, inshallah, after taking a break. See you, inshallah. Respected brothers and sisters, stay with us. Inshallah, we'll be back in a minute, okay? Stay with us. See you, inshallah, in the next session. Thanks to IRIB English Radio and also Sevier International Schools Network. So, we will be back. Let's recite a salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد في الفرج.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Sevier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.